Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Cherian. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I invited you to be my guest today because I'm particularly interested in talking about a particular topic. I've shared that with you. Usually I don't invite my guests to come on with a sort of an agenda in mind, but working on a book project, as you know, and I want to get some of your thoughts in this because I know you think very critically and carefully about what it is we do as fundraising professionals, and I want to talk about short-termism. But before we do that, how about we just let you introduce yourself and let the world know why it is Jason wants to put your opinion. Let's sort of get a sense of who you are in the world so that we know why I'm so interested in your opinion on things.
Well, I appreciate that, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be with you and to talk with you about these important issues. I am Cherian Kochi. I work at Des Moines Performing Arts. I've been helping out in the philanthropy sector for about 25 years now and in a wide variety of different spaces, and just love talking about really the why around some of the things that we do. So that's what we've talked about on your podcast before. And today, I guess we're going to talk about short-termism and how some of these ideas that we think might make sense need a little bit more critical reflection before we go out and implement them, potentially to our detriment.
Yeah. So let's give some context first, and then we'll sort of go down the rabbit trail of getting a little more theoretical. And I've got a source here I want to reference and get your thoughts on as well that I'm going to also be referencing. But Cherian, I think, and we talked a little bit about this before we hit the record button. So for the sake of our listeners, here we are sort of still on the, perhaps maybe on the back end of sort of figuring out how we're all going to respond to COVID-19. And I think the observation that you and I have both made to varying degrees is that some nonprofit leaders out there would really like to, when we look at private foundations who perhaps have lots of resources, we'd really like them to just sort of, some of us would sort of just call on them and say, why don't you just exhaust all these resources, give them to us, solve our short-term problems, and let us be on our merry way. Why do you think, Cherian, that that's a particularly problematic notion? And how much out there do you think that, there's a better word than that, but how pervasive would you say that idea is? That, if we surveyed 100 nonprofit professionals And we said, would you like the chair, you know, the foundations that they're associated with to just liquidate themselves and solve all of our short-term problems? How many do you think would necessarily would say, yeah, let's do that? I mean, I think I've given you enough to get you started, right?
Sure. So let's start there, and then I'll give you the three reasons why I think it's problematic. Sadly, I think a lot of people, a lot of organizations would say, you know, empty out the piggy bank. This is the rainy day that you were waiting for. Now's the time to spend down the corpus, pay off, you know, whatever we can to solve the problems that we're facing right now. I would venture to guess that it's somewhere in the majority. If we surveyed 100, I'm afraid that it'd be more than 75%. But, you know, we've not done that surveying. I don't think that's happened in the sector. But just from how people are talking out there in forums and online, I think that seems to be a sentiment that's out there. And let me just start with a caveat to say, I work in the arts. In the middle of a pandemic and an economic recession,
right?
I get it. I understand.
Right.
It is
of course
bad.
You do.
We have lost half of our staff, not just on my team, but as an organization as a whole. And it has been hard. And I see friends in other areas where it's been hard. And people have lost their jobs. And, you know, the Chronicle indicates that we've lost somewhere around 1 million nonprofit jobs. So it's a bad situation. And so I completely understand where people are coming from with regard to we need to figure out a solution. The reason why I don't think paying or emptying the corpus is a good solution, and I want to clarify, there are two positions here that are distinct, one that's potentially more reasonable and one that I think is unreasonable.
Right.
The reasonable position is foundations could spend more. They could spend more than they normally have in order to address some of these issues. I would argue that most foundations or many foundations are doing that already. If you look at information out there from organizations that study foundations, they're typically not sticking with that 5% minimum threshold that's required by law, at least here in the United States. Many of them are spending more, and they're the organizations that have greater assets. The ones that are spending really near that 5% are the ones that really don't have a ton of assets to be able to give out anyway. So I sit on the board of a foundation that has only $100,000 in assets. So the 5% that they do, we're trying to do a little bit more. But if they don't have that to spend, you know, our bylaws say that we need to have $100,000 as a minimum. So we can't go below that. And that's really to fund programs in the future. The reason why I think this is problematic, first of all, is because of what you and I have talked about, and that is a presentism bias or short-termism. And it's a view that the problems that we're facing right now are the problems that are the worst things. And that has to do a lot with our personal psychology. We're worried about the things that have, we are proximately affected by them. The reality is we don't know what's going to happen a year from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And some of these institutions are designed to resolve those problems long-term. And that's why they have a corpus. And so without knowing the future, which none of us could know, it is potentially irresponsible for us to eliminate those ongoing sources of funding. And that, I think, ties into the second problem, which is that most nonprofits are founded upon a cause that doesn't have a solution. That is, there will always be, and there has always been, people who are hungry, people who are homeless. I work in an arts organization. We're always going to need the arts. There are certainly issues that can get close to being solved, but I'm on the board of our local Rotary, and there are still cases of polio. It's a disease that has been quote unquote eradicated, but there are still instances of polio. So we're sort of playing whack-a-mole even with diseases to a certain extent. So there isn't necessarily a solution. What we're doing as nonprofits is resolving how we're fixing that problem long-term. So how can we minimize the number of people who are significantly adversely affected by hunger or homelessness? But not to say, you know, $1 million and we can never have homelessness again. That just seems silly to me. And I just don't understand how that would be the case. But there are certainly other causes where you will always need new creators, new artists, new innovations, even in the nonprofit space.
Yeah.
And then please.
Yeah. So clarify if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is, and I don't want to lose your thought there where you were going there. So pencil that down on your notepad or something, because I don't want to lose that third thought. But for the sake of my listeners, I want to make sure that I'm getting this right. So you would sort of argue that perhaps the only reason an organization would make the case that any one foundation might would sort of liquidate their assets and sort of say, here, take all this and keep yourself afloat, would be on the assumption that whatever that organization's mission is, which only gets to some of the stuff that I don't think some of the people who are advocating for this notion actually think about the complexity of this. But if you're going to appeal to a private foundation, hey, liquidate your assets, give them all to us, and help us sort of navigate the next 18 months, you're also in some ways sort of inadvertently arguing that in 18 months, whatever problem we exist to solve is going to go away.
That's exactly right.
Is that sort of what I'm hearing? If we just sort of put it in very simple terms.
So it's funny you mentioned that, because that is the third point, which is that most nonprofits don't have a theory of change that says, if you give us X amount of dollars, we can solve this problem. There are some that do, or that would develop a theory of change that comes really close to that. But a giant influx of cash is not necessarily the thing that moves towards the solvency that these organizations are really looking for. So a lot of times, organizations will talk about how all of this money is tied up in areas where, you know, there's tax efficient giving and it's hidden in foundations and whatnot. And so if we were to go to these organizations and say, spend it all down, give us all this money, I'm not sure we really know what we would do with that money in a way that that actually solves the problem or addresses the problem for more than, you know, a period of time. It depends, obviously, on the amount of money. But the assumption is that the nonprofit can steward that amount of money longer term than the foundation can, which I think causes a whole bunch of other problems, right? Because a lot of nonprofits prior to the pandemic and prior to the economic issues that we're facing today were on the verge of collapse. They did not have the resources needed to kind of keep themselves afloat. And so when we think about this mentality, what if we did this in 2008 when there was a recession and down the corporate? We'd be absolutely screwed right now.
Right. Or if we did it in 2001, right after September 11th, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Or, I mean, you know, longer back in history, you know, there are all kinds of examples of where the argument being made now is ahistorical. It, you know, if we had done this before, we would be in a lot of trouble today. And I promise you, I am not a fortune teller, but I promise you, this is not the last pandemic.
Right. And there will be another one. The shit will hit the fan again, right?
It will. And I mean, maybe there'll be another pandemic that isn't as bad as this. Maybe it'll be worse. I don't know. But I promise you, there will be another economic recession.
Right. And I don't want to. Yeah. Okay. So Rob Reich, and he's not the Rob Reich that most people are familiar with, but Rob Reich at Stanford is a sociologist, and he wrote a book a number of years ago. He wrote a book that came out about the same time that in 2018, a couple other authors that were getting sort of into a sort of a social critique of the way that philanthropy sort of functions in society. Okay. And I don't think the name of the book is called Just Giving, Stanford professor. And I don't think a lot of us who were reading these books, and they usually what I tended to see was I can't think of his name now. The author, forgive me, folks, the guy who's sort of saying deconstructing wealth, decolonizing wealth. Yes, Edgar. Yeah. So came out at the same time that Edgar's book was coming out, Decolonizing Wealth, good critique. I totally get it. I would have liked to have seen him sort of push back a little bit more on the Enlightenment era and sort of understanding where some of that sort of decolonizing thinking comes from. But anyway, Reich's book, if you pick up Just Giving, and I think a lot of people are paying attention to the other books, but if you pick up his book, he's actually making the argument that I think you and I are pretty much aligned on in some ways, is this idea that maybe these large foundations should only be focused on long-termism, only willing to give to not being willing to fund short-term initiatives. So they wouldn't even be concerned necessarily. He's making a case that if the private foundation has a reason to exist that differentiates itself from the quote-unquote nonprofit sector that exists today for the purposes of direct service, so to meet short-term needs. He's not invalidating, dismissing the importance of short-term needs, but what he's in some cases doing is he's saying, maybe we need to draw a line in the sand and say these private foundations need to be more oriented towards long-term, absolutely solve the problems. Once they're solved, shut the thing down, versus those people who are solving, who's hungry today, who needs to be educated today, because somebody's going to need to be cared for tomorrow sort of problems. What's your thoughts on that?
So I think, I haven't read the book, just in terms of that line of thinking, I think it's absolutely, it makes a lot of sense. I think it is safe to say that we can criticize grant-making policies as they currently exist, or the way in which foundations approach solving problems and work with them to address these problems without then also having to say, spend out your corpus. And I think one of the things that we always miss is there's sort of this nonprofit assumption that the people in foundations are going to work in yachts and, you know, it's their Rolls Royce that comes and picks them up. But, you know, the staffers at foundations, at least the ones that I've dealt with, even the largest foundations, are not multimillionaires. They're regular folks who are making pretty much the same salary as other nonprofit folks or in rare occasion private sector folks. So if we spend out those foundations, then they're not going to have a job. I still think there's an opportunity for us to have conversations about what's wrong with the way in which foundations approach problems? Because a lot of them are looking for the new, cool, innovative thing that you're doing, when in reality, that's not what our organizations are designed to do, right? So if it's addressing hunger or homelessness, they might need functionally annual support, right? They might need to support an organization for the long haul. And if that's really what you care about as a foundation, you should build your systems that enable you to do that, as opposed to saying, we'll give you 1 year of funding and then we hope that you'll do something that will somehow otherwise become sustainable without the funding from us. So I think that there are valid criticisms of a lot of foundation practices. But I think, at least from what I understand, Reich has a good point here about how foundations should understand, like, if you're really in it to make a big hit, then you probably should sunset. You know, you should design your funding policies to give away what you have and then sunset your organization. I know plenty of organizations that are set up that way.
Yeah, there's a risk. That's the other thing that he talks about in his book and the critique. And it's an easy read, folks, but you do have to think critically and carefully as you're reading through it. I would certainly recommend it. We'll put a link in the show notes. Okay. What Reich is talking about is that if we allow the organizations if we encourage the foundations to think more long-term, so they're not solving your next 18 months, how do we navigate through COVID-19? How do we make sure that the payroll gets met? But what they're actually solving is, how do we actually eliminate this disease? How do we eradicate this problem? How do we ensure that this never comes up again sort of problems? Then they also have a risk element that typically the short-termism sort of thinking doesn't allow for or permit. So if you think about the risk tolerance that most of us sort of tolerate in society, but certainly in the nonprofit sector, those short-term dollars are typically oriented towards things that are not really focused on risk. Then they're not high-risk opportunities. And what he's saying is that if you focus some of these philanthropic or foundation dollars on the longest term and the highest risk opportunities to which to solve our society's biggest problems, in reality, what you're going to do is you're going to put some of these short term, you know, organizations out of business is really what you're going to do. And that's kind of the question. There's sort of three parts to this that I really wanted to pull out of you, Cheerion. But right here in the middle of the conversation, what I'm interested in. So at the college that I teach at, I'll be teaching. I've got 60 students, two different sections starting next week. And one of the conversations we'll be talking about is Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, and the idea that we as a society have become so narrowly focused on our identities and the identities of others, of that of a consumer, that we've lost sort of that identity of a citizen. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder if that's problematic in light of what we're talking about here, because I kind of listen to some of this short-termism sort of thinking and some of the response that we're hearing and some of the people that are advocating for this idea. And I kind of wonder if they even have sort of reconciled why we as a sector and why the civil society, sort of the third sector, if you will, sort of the third bubble, you know, you got the private sector, you've got the government, and you've got how many of our colleagues, going back to the idea of a survey, maybe we'll create a survey on the back end of this podcast. How many of us do you think actually understand that the third sector sort of exists to sort of address a lot of the things that both the government, Washington and the White House and so forth, and then the private sector, so like Walmart and McDonald's, how many of us do you think that when we're advocating for these issues has really even thought critically enough about why we exist to the point where they can have an opinion about this?
So this is going to be a really unpopular opinion, but I'm famous for those.
Yeah, and it's a turn in the conversation, too. So I think we're going to keep people going here. So, I need you to just unload, because I'm going to put this in a book. So
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Say all the unpopular things.
Yeah, so you can just lay it on us.
So unfortunately, I think a lot of our colleagues in the sector have sort of this self-denial I don't know what exactly the right word would be, but they sort of default to an expectation that charity or philanthropy ought to end, that we need to kind of figure out a way to work ourselves out of business so that we don't have to do this, especially when it comes to fundraising. I hear from so many organizations, they're like, you know, we want to figure out a way to not have to fundraise. So who can we talk to give us a big chunk of cash so that we never have to do that again? And I don't know exactly what the sources of that are, but I think part of it is we are a very new country in the grand scheme of history and the world. And so we have this very limited kind of historical understanding, and the context around us, our environment, is very, very new. I have a friend in the UK, her name is Claire. We were talking at one point a few years ago, and she was saying, you know, there's a portion of my house that was built in the 1600s. And I'm like, you have a kitchen that's older than my country. Right. And that's odd, right? Like, yeah, that's not something that I would necessarily think about. And of course, like, people where my family comes from, I mean, we have, thousands of years of history to draw upon that we can look at and see. And I think the reason why that's important is because we tend to forget that philanthropy has its roots in the beginning of time, right? We have Hebrew scripture that talks about the building of the temple, exactly what your book is going to talk about in terms of cathedral thinking. David's raising money in an exact donor pyramid, right? Yes, he's giving money first. He's asking leaders to give money after that, and then going to the Israelites in general to give money to build a temple that his son will build. Yeah. And so this is something that we've lost as a society is, you know, we've become very dependent upon big sources of money. And I have kind of a generic distrust of government in general and what they're able to do and able to do well. But I think a lot of our colleagues feel like if we just enable tax policy to fund these things, we could fund it at a greater level and resolve those issues. I just don't think that government is the right source to address these issues. I don't think government is designed to be innovative. I don't think it's designed to see the problem and be on the ground and resolve that issue in a meaningful way.
Yeah. And that's what we talk about in my class. So you got these three bubbles and Venn diagram sort of thing. And yeah. you got the three bubbles, and one is the civil society, one is the government, and one is essentially Walmart and the private sector. And they all contribute to society in different ways. And what I think is also what I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on, because this is a big part of this writing project I'm working on, is they each require of us as people and human beings to sort of exist in society very differently. So when you're thinking of being, when you think of the government, you think about being a voter. And when you think about being a Walmart and McDonald's, you typically think of yourselves as a consumer. But what Putnam talks about in his book, Bowling Alone, is in many ways, because these two powerhouse drivers of society have sort of played the role that they have in the last, you know, several decades, is that we've lost that ability in civil society to be citizens. Mm-hmm. And we've even allowed that word citizen to sort of be hijacked in some ways and be defined largely by the government, for example, as if there's only sort of two ways to exist. But what he's making the argument is that to exist in society as a citizen, you have to, and I'm bringing this back around to short-termism, you have to, as a citizen, sort of, there's no, that's the one thing that sort of keeps us in many ways in check with our own sort of natural human innate selfishness, narcissism sort of stuff.
Yep.
Walmart knows that when I walk in there, they're only selling me, the one individual with the wallet in my pocket, to buy a product or a service, whatever they can sell me. When you become a citizen, you own responsibility. You begin to sort of take responsibility not only for the needs of those people around you that you care about today, but also the needs of those people that are going to come tomorrow. And so it extends, you know, our view of the world. And it also sort of changes our perspective of the government, because we don't see the government as always solving all our problems. If we can sort of hunker down and survive the next 18 months, we can collectively as a society collaborate and start to solve some of those problems that are going to extend beyond COVID-19. Am I right?
I 100% agree. And I think, you know, the consumeristic mindset is one that starts to push in on philanthropy, and that does so in a dangerous way. And then much of the government mentality creeps into philanthropy in a lot of ways that I think are unhealthy. I mean, I as I mentioned to you before, I think philanthropy is the way to solve or way to address the problem in society. And I think it's the only thing that ever has. And philanthropy needs to push against both of those influences where appropriate and act as checks and balances. But I think what you're seeing in government right now, and this is probably a little bit of a rabbit trail, so I'll keep it short. Everybody complains about what the government is doing at all times. I don't know why anyone would run for public office right now, because you can't ever get it right. And you see where everyone is concerned about something that's happening at government, at any government level, and they're blaming somebody. And so what at its core government has done, and this isn't a party issue, it's the structures of government. And there's a really good book by Catherine Gale that I would recommend, and the five forces of government that indicate why our systems are broken. But the government has co-opted what it means to be a citizen or a civic participant in a way that's super unhealthy. And it's pit people against one another, in the US in particular. And what philanthropy does, what the civil society does, is look at issues of community and helps us to see the needs of one another in that space and to find ways that we can help one another, particularly at a local level. The science says that the best way to address hunger and homelessness is actually for local communities to know exactly who those people are and to help them, you know, individually at a very hyper-local level. Where like much of the institutional processes that have been developed just recreate hunger and homelessness. So I think there's an important, and I'm looking forward to reading this book that you recommended, but I think there are important ways in which we as a sector really need to redefine the boundaries, push against those areas where encroachment has already occurred, and reform what it means to be a civil society. And, you know, some of the work that I'm doing with Rogari, the fundraising think tank, is about fundraising as a profession, which is super complicated. But I think, you know, historically, we've seen people be civic fundraisers, right? Whether it's at the PTO level or, you know, my kids are in scouts. And so we do fundraising in those areas and whatnot. But we have this history of having local problems that we want to solve and getting together and addressing those issues, whether it's monetarily or through volunteering. And that's where I think real problems come to light and where they get solved. And we come up with real smart solutions that are locally tailored.
So, Tyrion, when I reached out to you, I explained to you that I was working on this book project, and I'm working on this particular chapter. And a lot of this chapter, I've just recently read. This is sort of the brass tacks of where I wanted to get to in our conversation today. So, for the sake of our listeners, we got about 10 more minutes because I really want to pull some more out of Tyrion in terms of sort of the practical implications of what we talked about. And I really want to sort of unpack this notion of what it is to do cathedral thinking or cathedral projects, because I don't think that's a term or a phrase that we hear a lot of. Perhaps it's the religiosity or something that sort of causes us in the nonprofit sector to sort of avoid that. And Jeff and Richard Perry in their Jeff Shrivels and Richard Perry in their new book, it's not just about the donor reference this, but I just want to read this quote. Because this is where they talk about long-term thinking as it relates to the way that nonprofit organizations embark on these capital campaigns. And I have oftentimes thought that the way that we embark on capital campaigns is programmatic, and that while we like to say that it feels long-term, it's really not all that long-term. He says, because the argument that Jeff and Richard are making in their book is that campaigns oftentimes hurt the major gift opportunity. They say, by definition, a campaign is a short-term event. There is a specific project and a limited time and a specific goal. And that's where, in most cases, the problem starts. We say most cases because we have met fundraisers that have this right. So what they're saying is that some people know how to look at these capital campaigns. There is some of us out there who sort of get this, and some of us who don't. But what I've come to realize that Jeff and Richard are talking about, and as it relates to what you and I have been talking about, is this idea of cathedral thinking or cathedral projects. And if you sort of do your homework, if any of my listeners do their homework on this idea of cathedral thinking is the idea that the project that you're embarking on extends beyond what the group or the individual can accomplish on their own tenure, on their own sort of watch. Mm-hmm. And I think, and Richard and Jeff were very gracious in their way of sort of alluding to this idea. I like to push the envelope, kind of like you do, Tyrion, a little bit. Cathedral thinking gets us beyond our own egos. Mm-hmm. And I think if we sort of pull all this together and if we sort of boil this down to what we're getting at here today, is you got these, we're in the midst of whatever our problems are, whatever crisis we're in the midst of, September 11th, you know, the recession 2008, COVID-19, or whatever problem, you know, plagues us tomorrow. Some of us just want to solve in the short term because it sort of salvages our ego, and we don't want to sort of be perceived as having failed. And capital campaigns in some ways work the same way. And I'm a critic of, most of my listeners know that I'm sort of critiquing the way that a lot of the story gets told from experts, people in my role. And I think the story that's being told when it comes to capital campaigns is somewhat flawed because it does sort of sell the short term. It does sort of sell the very transactional. And can the sector in your mind, Tyrion, sort of get beyond what can be accomplished by one CEO, one board of directors, one chairperson of the board? Can we get beyond that and really begin to sort of flourish, perhaps both in terms of fundraising, but also as a sector as a whole? I put a lot out there, but great. I think you know where I'm going.
I do. So I'll answer that question and then make three quick points.
I think there was like 12 questions in there.
So the last question you asked is, can we overcome? And I think the answer is, it is possible. And I'll talk about how. I think it's highly unlikely because of a wide variety of factors. most, I think the flip side of your comment about ego is just our need to see something accomplished. We want to, we've been trained to talk about impact as fundraisers. We want to show donors impact, and we want that impact to happen right away. So we've sort, and I don't think that's wrong. I do that all the time in my work. And I think there's an important element of describing the impact, but there, we've sort of coached the donors and our philanthropic system to expect immediate results, to expect a change based upon them giving. And it's sort of this, it's a gamification at its core of you press this lever, you flip this switch, and you get this reward, right?
Yeah.
And we're trying to build that, you know, give reward mentality. Again, right. That's not necessarily wrong, but we have to be cognizant of what that eliminates or how that frames our donors' thinking, especially when it comes to capital campaigns or long-term projects. So in some of my writing, I talk about a Ulysses Pact. And this is the concept of, you know, binding ourselves to the mast, that no matter what our temptation is to burn resources or to do something immediate, we have someone in, at the table who is required to think about the future generations. What does it look like from a long-term perspective? And the example of that from my own work is, you know, our organization's 40 years old, and we have, when my boss goes out and talks about the organization, I have him end with the 40-year strategic plan. That is, we've been around for 40 years. What does the next 40 years look like? And so he's, I hate to say this about Jeff, but he's going to be dead in 40 years. I'm going to be well retired in 40 years. We're not going to be around to see that. But what we need to talk about with donors is, what does the world look like after we're all gone? And to not be afraid of planting trees that we won't ever get to sit in the shade of. So, again, you know, I talk about my daughter in that example. And what does the world look like in 2099 when, you know, she's 84 years old and she's experiencing the world. And environmentalists, for what it's worth, environmental nonprofits get this better, I think, than many other nonprofit sectors. So perhaps we can take a, you know, a lesson from the Sierra Club or Clean Water Action, something like that, thinking about future generations. I think the second element of all of this is that we can have discussions that are those kind of long-term discussions by reshaping what it means to have a short-term impact. And so as we're talking about an annual report or our strategic plans, what does it look like to introduce into those concepts the long-term plan for the organization that doesn't have to have milestones and markers and all of those things? It's just, you know, here's, it really is recapturing the vision statement of your nonprofit and saying, we're still moving towards this thing. It's not there yet, and it's not going to be there for a while, but we're still, our eye is on that prize. And the last thing, which again is sort of far afield, but my friend Mark Pittman and I are writing about this, and I think for a journal, and I think one of the challenges that we face as a colonized country, a colonizer country, is we have this colonization influence. And so Mark and I are writing a piece about slavery economics and how our entire mentality when it comes to industrialization and progress has been ingrained in us about making incremental progress and how we can move the needle. And so you all know this as fundraisers. You're like, you raised $100,000 last year. Your boss tells you your goal is 150. Why?
Yeah.
Because that's what we do here, right?
Yeah.
And so we've ingrained that not only in ourselves, but in our culture as a whole. We need to have the new fastest thing. We need to be moving forward. And we've lost the concept of just rest, of just this is where we are. And this is, we're resolving these problems as best we can in the community that we live in. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I think it's possible for us to overcome these issues and really develop cathedral thinking, but it's going to require a wholesale reversion, honestly, of how we've talked to donors and how we think about management and leadership in the sector and what it requires of us as we even talk about internal metrics, because we really need to be focused on what is the next 40, 100 years look like.
So my the writing project that I'm working on, Cheerion, as I've sort of described some of the pieces in it, unlike The Colonizer, I'm spending a lot of time looking at Paulo Freire's stuff when he's looking at the way that we educated children in Brazil. He was looking at this in the 1950s and 60s, and he would have been looking through a critical theory lens similar to the way that we would look as it relates to what Edgar has been writing about with colonization. And he would basically say the same thing. And I think the case that I'm trying to make as it relates to long-term thinking is that the colonizers or the quote-unquote educators in our space are the experts. And I think in some ways what we're trying, what I'm trying to reconcile, and what I think guys like what Jeff and Richard are trying to reconcile, is that guys like you, me, and any of the experts who sort of have those privileged posts to sort of stand in front of a couple hundred fundraising. Mark is certainly one of those, and we have plenty of colleagues who do this sort of work. I don't know that we're educating our constituencies, are the people who sort of give us that privileged post in such a way that they're thinking long term. And so, you know, are we ready in your mind to handle some of the messy complexity, unpredictableness that sort of comes with that long-term thinking where we sit down with a client, for example, and sort of assert the idea that, hey, we don't know what the future holds. We can embark on something over the next 5 years, but you know, my ability to write a feasibility study, which is usually one of those typical outcomes of a consulting relationship. I mean, you can't imagine, Cheerion, the number of people that I've talked to in the last eight. I'm sure you can imagine the number of people that in the last 18 months have looked at that feasibility study that they got written by some guru 18 months before that, that has now basically flown out the window. It seems to me like we need to change the way that we do our work so as to, like Jeff and Richard talk about in their book, focus on more meaningful relationships, engaging with individuals that ultimately are most inclined to give us these extraordinary gifts, but not get our egos so wrapped up in building these short-term projects. Even if it's, you know, even if it's 100,000 square feet project, it's not necessarily building a cathedral. Do you follow sort of what I'm trying to raise the bar on my peers, the people who are sort of in my seat, who have that privileged seat of being given, you know, the AFP chapter in Kansas City is enlisting me to come out in the fall, stand up in front of a couple hundred fundraisers and cast a vision for where this is going. I think the bar needs to be raised for me. And what Fieri would be saying and what, you know, the colonizing folks would be saying is that we've been telling the wrong story. You know, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I would appreciate it if the bar was raised for consultants. I think it's important. I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the kind of economic incentive to not do that, to not raise the bar, because every consultant that I know is getting a lot of work revising somebody else's work that they did 18 months ago. And
organizations have to rewriting that same damn feasibility study, right?
Exactly. And, I mean, that's the reality is, you know, you have people who started a capital campaign before, and now they have to redo all of their work and it's more money out the door. And I, you know, I don't want my consulting friends to lose work, but it would require sacrifice on many people's parts to the bottom line in order to really approach it from a different perspective. And I mean, I think about nonprofit strategy first and foremost as a cone-shaped concept, where our strategy has guidelines that create the edges of where our strategy is permitted to go. But within that, there are a whole bunch of different variables, and we need to kind of agree as an organization that our strategy is going to fall somewhere inside of that cone, not outside the boundaries of our mission and our vision and our values. But there are a whole bunch of variables that are going to change, but also to really think about, you know, that, again, that long, long-term approach, and then work backwards from there to see what are the things that we're willing to undertake during the next year or 5 years or something like that. But I would, again, I would love to see, particularly for consultants, that bar to be raised. I think it would be a struggle. I think potentially nonprofits can push back and say, you know, what does this look like? I don't know tactically really what that would permit or prohibit, but I think it's important, at least, you know, as Freire talks about, or some of the other authors in that space, to think about really what is it that we want. And I keep pushing back on our side, the people who are speakers, that we really aren't experts. I said this in a webinar yesterday. I'm not an expert. I read a lot and I've talked to a lot of people and I'm trying to condense it into a way that makes sense. But the sort of this cult of expertise has really now created this cultishness around hyper tactical focused fundraising, where the only thing that people want to learn about or read about or think about or consume is what do I do? How to, what next? And I produce a lot of that content. I get
well, yeah. It's what can, it's the short-termism. Yeah. It's what can I, what does the information in the world right here in this moment actually enable me to predict? And the further you go out, which ultimately, in my mind, the further you go out when you're training someone, when you're teaching someone, when you're sort of building a what Fieri would talk about, when you're building sort of a healthy young, when you're helping build sort of the minds of young people, the further you go out, the less likely you are to predict the future. And what Fieri talks about, because he's pushing back on the notion of what is expertise. I mean, the teacher in front of the classroom is the quote unquote expert. And oftentimes they're quote exploiting the naive sort of way of thinking of the individual who's sitting in the seat. And what he's saying here is that when education is being done right, your boots are on the ground. You're not up on a platform, if you will.
Exactly.
Your content is very valid content, but it's shallow and it's void of any meaning if you don't have the context for which your students are put. And I'm learning this. I'm like learning this right in the moment, because I'll be in the classroom and I'm trying to get my students to not only take what it is I'm saying, but insert their contextual understanding of the world into that. And what Fieri's saying is that when you do that, you create this learning opportunity, not only for the person in the seat in the classroom, but the person standing at the front of the room.
Yeah.
And that's not an expert or a guru. That is someone that's a facilitator of learning. And that's right. Someone who's trained to be there. And you're not dismissing the validity of what they have to say. But it is taking away some of that ego.
Exactly. Right. To your earlier point about ego, I mean, I think, you know, one of the virtues of sort of this postmodern application is that you have to open yourself up to saying, I could be wrong. I'm presenting this information to you, but I'm ready for pushback. I'm ready to accept that my positions here could be wrong, and your life experience and your reading and research is going to be different from mine. So let's have a conversation so that we can come to ultimately, you know, a better understanding of truth. And that ironically goes back to Mill and right. The marketplace of ideas. Yes. And all of that, concept that he's developed.
I think we're edging really close to the one of the chapters. Cheering, you'll appreciate this. Is Taylor at the beginning of the 20th century had his one best way, and he was an efficiency expert. And I think that's part of, and I think that's and anybody who follows what I've been talking about on LinkedIn lately, it's this notion of sort of being a Wizard of Oz. And what the Wizard of Oz had to do is he had to build a closed system. And a closed system is that system in which you can predict and you can control all the variables. Well, when you're working with human beings inside the organization, as well as human beings outside the organization, like your donors, it's not a closed system. It's not running like the engine in my minivan. It's running like a complex adaptive system that has all these sort of unpredictable elements to it. And we have to approach it like systems thinkers would say, that we have to explore it, not exploit it.
Yeah.
And I think the experts in the room, the people who've been telling the story, and this is how I think we can bridge Fieri's stuff with the stuff that Edgar's talking about with colonization and what I'm talking about with what's called narration sickness, the way the story's being told, is that we've got to transition our sector, our profession to a more exploratory, which is just a more palatable term. I mean, think yeah. about it. If we just said, I do exploratory work, who jumps back at that? But when you say I'm exploiting the names and the names and individuals that are in my database, it's like, ooh, is that really what you do?
The analogy that I use is that it's the difference between hunting and farming, that a lot of times fundraisers are trained to hunt, to find targets and to extract or exploit those resources.
Yeah.
And you want the big kill, right? You want to shoot one bullet and solve the problems, whether it goes back to that concept that we talked about earlier with draining the corpus of the foundation or a major gift or whatever. But what really I believe we need to do as fundraisers or nonprofit folks is to focus on building the philanthropic ecosystem, to farm, to lay seed where it will become fruitful. And some of that seed's going to grow, some of it's not, but we're tending crops and we're replanting that and season over season over season. Our job is to continue to bear, to help the ground bear fruit. And we are tending that garden. We're not doing anything. Jim Langley talks about this a lot with his analogy of an orchard,
yes.
major gift officer, like ramming a tree. And of course, you know, apples are going to fall, but the tree's dead, you know? So if we think of our role as planting the orchard and tending the orchard, we're going to approach it from a much better place. And I think that's not tactical per se, you know, it's more esoteric, but I think that may be the solution to what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a different storyteller too. I mean, what I appreciate in my conversations with you, Cherian, with a lot of my guests is because I do push back and most of my listeners will recognize that I don't tend to have a lot of experts and self-proclaimed gurus on here. I like to get the people who are on the ground because I think the expertise is on the ground. One group of writers in higher education right now are writing about how our sector, our society is moving away from awareness, a belief that the expertise that's out there can be found sort of in these quote unquote emerald cities.
Yeah.
But in fact, the expertise is out in the field. And so if I'm not interacting with you, then I'm not interacting just like my students in my classroom. If I'm not interacting with those people, I'm really not going to enlighten myself. I'm not going to learn. And I'm going to get real weary and exhausting myself, really stale. And I think that's where our profession, the consulting, those of us in the consulting ranks, I think we get very quickly stale because we're selling the same sort of stuff. It sounds like a one best way. It sounds very algorithmic and formulaic. And then I got a guy like you who's out in the field, who's reading a lot of the same stuff I am. And it's like, wow, put these two sort of heads together, come up with some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. To paraphrase Thoreau said, there's nothing wrong with castles in the air, but you have to put the foundations underneath them. I think that's true of the ivory tower as well. There's nothing wrong with ivory tower discussion, but we need to have street level grounding for those
ideas. I mean, you're in a community I've never been in. And so if I'm not gathering insights and stuff from a guy like you or from a gal like the woman we just talked to in Kentucky, good luck, right? We could exhaust ourselves, Cherian. You're probably one of my favorite guys out in the field actually doing the work. I like that you're doing the work, but I also like that you're contributing to things like Rogeri and having conversations like with Mark and writing stuff, talking with our friends on the other side of the Atlantic. If there's somebody listening today that's genuinely interested in reaching out to you and perhaps continuing the conversation that we've started today, or perhaps starting up another one, I know you're good for that.
Yeah.
How would you suggest that they reach out to you?
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, it's always fun to talk to you. I've always enjoyed being in these discussions with you. I am accessible. I'm just building a website, cheriankoshi.org, cheriankoshy.org. I'm also on Twitter and LinkedIn, and I share content there. I don't have anything to sell or anything. I'm just put in a place where some of these writings are easily accessible.
It's certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.